ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिः श्रुणुयाम देवाः, भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः, स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तिष्ठुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः. स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृषश्रवाः, स्वस्ति न पूषा विश्ववेदाः, स्वस्ति न सार्क्षो अरिष्टनेमिः, स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु. ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः.
We're in verse, this one it's 24. What verse do you have? Verse number? Is it 20? Apani padoham.
Apani padoham achintya shaktihi. Apani padoham achintya shaktihi. Pashamya chakshus sa shrinomya karnaha. Aham vijanami vivikta rupaha. Nachasti vedta mama chit sadaham.
Apani padaha. Aham achintya shaktihi. Pashyami achakshuhu saha shrinomi akarnaha aham vijanami vivikta-rupaha nacha asti veta mama chit sadaham.
Apani padaha aham. I am free of hands and legs. I have no hands, I have no legs. And yet, pani means hands, pada means feet. I have no hands or feet. Pani pada. This is Kaivalya Upanishad, by the way. The end of the Kaivalya Upanishad. So, pani pada, I have no hands and feet. And yet, achintya shaktihi, my capacity, my power, is achintya, inconceivable, limitless. I have limitless capacity, limitless ability, limitless strength. Shakti is the capacity, strength, power. Is achintya. Chitta means to be able to think or conceive of something. Achintya means inconceivable. The power that I have, the capacity that I have is achintya, inconceivable. Pashami achakshuhu. I see. Pashami, I see. Right? But achakshuhu, I have no eyes. Right? I see, but I have no eyes. Achakshuhu. Shrinomi, I hear, but akaranaha, I have no ears. Okay, akaranaha. Aham vijanami, I know. Vijana means I know. I know everything. Aham vijanami. Vivikta-rupaha, I know everything, and yet vivikta-rupaha, I am separate from other than all things. I know everything. We need this for this will come a little bit later to make sense of this. I know everything, aham vijanami, but na cha asti veta. Nobody knows me. I know all. I know everything. But nobody knows me. I know you, but you don't know me. I know all, but nothing knows me. Na cha asti veta. Mama chit sadaham. For me, there's nobody, there's no veta mama, there's no knower of me from vetra. There's no knower of me. So nobody knows me. Chit sadaham. I am consciousness, which is chit. I am chit sadaham. I am consciousness, which is sada. Sada means always, nitya, free from time. I am consciousness, which is not subject to time. So I am always the consciousness, the changeless consciousness. Okay, so that's the verse. Which is vivikta rupaha, differentiated. I am the changeless consciousness, timeless consciousness, which is differentiated from everything. All is known to me. No one knows me. I am pure consciousness, changeless consciousness, free from time, which is vivikta, whose nature is vivikta, means differentiated from everything else. So that's the verse. It's all these verses now, this last few verses of the Kaivalya Upanishad, they're all what we call nididhyasana. They're verses that once you, as you gain this vision, these verses put into very succinctly what it is you need to recognize, what it is you need to bring to mind to recognize yourself. So there's a lot. Here's what capitalizes a lot. This Apanipada, the being free of hands, being free of hands and feet, seeing but having no eyes, hearing but having no ears, basically means my being, the conscious being that I am, is in fact completely independent of these things. These things are not away from me. In other words, if I'm seeing you, right? What's actually, let me just break it down for a minute in terms of just the eyes to start with. If I'm seeing you, what is actually happening is I'm using these physical eyes, right? These eyes, to focus on the room, for instance, to gain a thought modification which I illumine, right? The eyes create a perception in my mind which I am aware of. Do you see how that is? Any thought, any perception is something that my mind is necessary. The perception uses my mind to create a thought modification, and that thought modification I'm aware of. So you can just think, if I'm looking over here, now my eyes are creating a thought modification, a thought, we call it a vritti, a thought, which now I'm aware of. If I move here, now my eyes are looking in this direction, I'm now creating a thought modification, right, which I am aware of. You can't say you're not aware of it, right? That's why it's so useful sometimes just to close your eyes and watch the thoughts go by, and you can see, yes, I'm aware of it. Actually, every thought that I have, whether it be a perception or an imagination, definitely I'm aware of it. So far, so good. There's a subject-object differentiation. What I mean is, when I say subject-object differentiation, it's not that the awareness is over here and what I'm aware of is over there. I don't mean that at all. In fact, any thought that I have is pervaded by my awareness. Right? If it were away from my awareness, if the thought was away from my awareness, I wouldn't be aware of it. Right? And so the thought, actually, any perception I have is pervaded by my awareness. But when the thought goes, my awareness is still there, and now that awareness is pervading the next thought, and the next thought, and the next thought. But nothing happens to me. Right? Nothing at all. Because I'm still there. The thought is gone. The perception is gone. Say I use my sense organs to give myself that thought modification, which I'm aware of. Okay? Now, nothing's happening to me when I no longer am using my sense organs to perceive that. Okay? And when I no longer have the vritti, the thought modification, nothing's happening to me. I just remain the same, ready for the next vritti, next thought modification. That being so, what if I take away the eyes and take away the thought modification, which I'm illumining? Am I seeing? From my own nature, the consciousness itself, the awareness itself, is awareness seeing? Or does seeing require the sense organs and the thought modification? If I'm not the thought modification, the thought, because the thought or, if I say thought or perception, I'm meaning the same thing here. I'm using perception because it's coming from a sense organ, so I perceive the room, for instance. But the thought, the perception rises based upon using my eyes, and it goes away, right? It comes and it goes. Is that clear for everybody? I mean, it sounds, I guess, simple, but it's so absolutely profound, because if it comes and goes and it's generated by the sense organs, and I illumine, kind of like the sun in a sense, just illumining whatever is there, right? I myself am not seeing. My eyes are seeing, creating a thought modification which I illumine, but say I get rid of what's being illumined. It doesn't belong to me, because I'm not going anywhere, nor am I changing. I have this thought modification, I'm illumining that, so the consciousness pervades this thought modification, it pervades the next thought modification, it pervades the next thought modification. So I get rid of the thought modifications, what am I doing? Nothing. I'm not doing anything. I just am the chit, the conscious being, which remains always the same. That's why it says chit sada aham. I am consciousness, which remains always the same. Nothing happens to me at all. And so therefore, seeing is taking place. And without consciousness, there's not going to be any seeing. Consciousness is required for something to be known, you know. But so I am seeing from the standpoint of my sense organs and my mind, right? So it says, I am seeing, but I don't have any eyes. Because I am the consciousness. The eyes are an instrument. The thought modification is an instrument. It's an instrument. The mind is an instrument that's illumined by consciousness. So with the mind and the sense organs, I am seeing. But from my own standpoint, I'm not seeing at all. So this is something, this is what I was trying to make clear in the meditation, right? Every thought that you have, every perception that you have is taking place. This phenomena, this subject-object phenomena is taking place. Perceiver perceived, seer seen, hearer heard. All of this phenomena, you know, subject-object phenomena is taking place. And at the same time that all of these perceptions are taking place, at that same time, in that same place, same time and place, I am. And I'm not changing. I'm not seeing while seeing is taking place. So I'm both seeing and not seeing. It depends upon what the standpoint is. I'm seeing from the standpoint of my eyes and thought modification. I'm hearing from the standpoint of my ears, and thought modification with the ear, which the ear is using, is I'm grasping from the standpoint of my hands. Yeah. I'm walking from the standpoint of my feet. But from my standpoint, I'm not doing anything. And yet I'm a chintya shaktihi. The capacity that I have is inconceivable. So let me explain that. Not hearing, I'm hearing with no ears. I'm seeing with no eyes. I'm grasping with no hands. I'm walking with no feet. Okay? And yet myself, being free of all of these things, have limitless capacity. So what is the limitless capacity? Let me just give an easy example of limitless capacity that you have. Imagine a meadow. You can just imagine a meadow with trees and grass and animals and people walking in it, you know, with a sun and clouds and the sky and the warmth of the air. You can be carrying on a conversation, walking through the meadow along a path. You can all sit down in the meadow and have a picnic. In fact, you can do anything in the meadow that you want. You can even decide to leave the meadow. You can decide to be a character in the meadow. You can decide, rather than being a character in the meadow, walking through the meadow with your friends, you can dissociate from the character and just view the meadow as a whole, where you can say, in my imagination, I can say, I'm the meadow. The entire meadow with all of the trees and foliage, with the sun and the sky, with all of the animals and the birds and all of the people walking through the meadow. All of that comes from me, is sustained by me, and resolves into me. Because I can say, have an image of the meadow, imagine the meadow, withdraw the meadow. When I imagine the meadow as a whole, I'm the Lord of the meadow. Right? I am the creator of the whole meadow, the meadow world, the meadow, my meadow universe. I'm the creator of the meadow universe. And I'm the creator of everything in the meadow universe. Because of me, the creatures walking in the meadow universe have sense organs through which they can see. They have hands and they have feet through which they can grasp and walk. They have ears through which they can hear. The eyes and the ears and the mind and the voice and the movement all come from me. They all exist as part of my imagination, the laws and the very order that's contained in my meadow imagination. That's the Achintya Shakti. There's no limit to the capacity. We're just looking at this limitless capacity from the standpoint of me, the individual jiva, the individual, in reference to your ability to imagine, which is itself a limitless capacity, really. It's limited because your imagination is different than my imagination. But there's no end to the possibilities available to you in your imagination. So you can be infinitely creative in terms of your imagination. And that infinite creativity is something that is going to, that is governed by a complex network of laws. There's some interesting things to notice about your imagination. For instance, you imagine the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth, and the elementals. You can't really get beyond that. You can do all kinds of things, like you can make the sky red, whatever colors are available to you. But there's a certain order that you have in terms of what you have to work with in terms of your imagination. There's an infinite order, an infinite way that you can combine all of these things available to you. But the order and structure, you know, is something that is hard to get beyond. Mm. Put it that way. Mm. Even though there's infinite creativity within it, it's hard to get beyond that structure. We look at that imagination as my imagination, okay? Subjective. But once you differentiate yourself, the conscious being that you are, from your mind, your sense organs, the eye thought even, your perceptions, your body, this vivikta rupa, right? You've differentiated your being, or you recognize just through teaching and through contemplation, nididhyasana, that backs up that teaching. You see it at the time of teaching, but you also sit with the reality of it. Your being is not doing anything. As all of these things come and go and come and go, all of these experiences come and go and come and go, your being remains as the conscious presence in which all of this is occurring, itself not changing in any way. If you're not changing in any way, and I'm not changing in any way, the consciousness itself is not changing, the consciousness which you are is not changing. And all of the experiences, of course, are changing, coming and going. Then, in fact, that consciousness which can't be objectified as an object, what makes that consciousness limited? What makes it my consciousness versus your consciousness? What makes there be more than one consciousness, one being? Because no hands, no feet. Right? So you have hands, you have hands, you have hands, and I have hands. We all have hands. We all have hands. But the conscious being doesn't have any hands. So your hands are different from my hands. But I, the Sat-Chit, the conscious being that I don't have any hands. And so all of these different hands are not a statement about me. We all have different eyes. You have your eyes, your eyes, your eyes, my eyes, your eyes, your eyes. We all have eyes. I don't have any eyes. The conscious being that I'm, well, I don't have any eyes. And so you have eyes, you have eyes, you have eyes. Your body has eyes, the body has eyes. No. What about thoughts? You have thoughts, you have thoughts, you have thoughts, you have thoughts. I have thoughts. Consciousness, the conscious being that I am, doesn't have any thoughts. So, what makes me other than you? What are you going to use? We can say our bodies are different. Each body is different. One body is different from the other. So what, there's 10 bodies in the room. That does no statement at all on the nature of my being. They're objectified, after all. So when you sit as a statue, you know, just sitting relaxed, quiet, you see that the body is totally objectifiable. When you go back and forth towards just your own presence and the body, your presence doesn't change. And it's not objectifiable. By objectifiable, what I mean is, if I'm aware of my body, like, let me just give you a quick example. Right now, be aware of your little toe. I bet you weren't aware of it, right? So now I'm asking you to be aware of your little toe. Okay? Now be aware of the top of your head. You weren't having that perception before, right? You can objectify your body and then be aware of what you've objectified. If you're not objectifying it, then that object is not in your awareness, you know? You're only aware of, it's not that the body isn't here, but it's not in your awareness because your mind isn't focused on it. It's the same with a thought. Like if I ask you now, think of your front door at home. I'm sure you weren't thinking of it. Think of your front door, right? Now you're objectifying the front door as a memory, remembering it, right? But when I ask you now, okay, think of your living room couch, if you have one. Think of your living room couch or what functions of the couch. Okay, you weren't thinking about that. Now you're thinking about the couch and not the front door. Right? So it's even true with objects external to the body, but it's true of the body now. Think about your eyes. Okay, now you're aware of your eyes. But you weren't aware of your eyes. You're just using your eyes. So what I'm saying is perceptions are things. When I say objectification, I'm objectifying something, right? If I could be objectifying a thought, my thoughts are all objectified when a thought comes, and I'm objectifying the thought. I'm objectifying the physical body. I'm objectifying my breath. I'm objectifying my emotions. I'm objectifying my perceptions. And these things are all other than me. They're the subject-object relationship. Now say objectify your consciousness. And that's interesting because you can't objectify you, the conscious being that you are. You can't objectify you as an object because then who's doing the objectification? Like consciousness can't objectify consciousness and say, oh, look at the consciousness, as though there's something other than consciousness that's illumining the consciousness. Your being itself is self-evident. You can't separate it to objectify it into a subject-object relationship. And yet, it's self-shining, right? And so it's not unknown to you. It's just not objectified like all of the things in the creation, all of the things in the world, including your body, your mind, your sense organs, your thoughts. Those are all things that you need to objectify, in fact, in order to know them. But consciousness, you don't need to objectify to know it, because it's self-evident. You don't need to bring in another consciousness to light it up. And so it's an interesting, it's a different phenomenon. You are a different phenomena than all these other things. that require objectification for them to be known. You just simply are. You're the bottom line. You're the thing that, in fact, can't be objectified, but shines. Can't be changed, because it can't be objectified. The conscious being that you are doesn't exist as something within time and space. Like we can, with our eyes, we can look at each other and we have dimension and all of this. But I'm looking at you and differentiating myself from you because of my eyes, because of my sense organs. But these sense organs are themselves objectified. And I can be blind. I still am. But I don't have my sense. I don't have the eyes. I can be deaf. I still am. I just don't have that instrument. Look at what happens to you when you meditate. You're practicing samadhi, or you're absorbing your mind through meditative techniques, and your mind becomes so quiet and then focuses as a result into consciousness rather than taking on a thought modification of something out here. You know, or a daydream or an intellection or focusing on an imagination. Those are all objectifications. Say, instead of letting your mind objectify through the sense organs or just through imagining, you just focus on the awareness that's illumining the mind. What happens then? The mind as though erases itself. It has no content. But it's erasing itself. It's cleaning from itself any type of objectification. And then all that's left is consciousness illumining a mind that is, instead of being active, is focusing on the subject. And so now you have awareness illumining a mirror. Now my mind, through my sense organs, is like a mirror to this. But what about when I pull in my mind? You know, and it's not doing anything, then I'm just abiding there as conscious being. And now say I want to look at the consciousness. Who's going to look at it? Nobody needs to look at it. That's the thing. Nobody needs to look at it because it's consciousness. You don't need consciousness to be aware of consciousness. So when you're meditating, you're shutting down all of your perceptions. And then who's left? When you shut down all your perceptions, who's left? Me. Just me. But that's the key. The one who is always left. That can't be negated. That you can't move away from. Is me. That's why this chit sada aham, I am I. Who am I? I am the conscious being that is sat, means it always, sada means always, free from time. Time belongs to what I can objectify, not to the consciousness that can't be objectified. You try, such an interesting contemplation is to try to change that being, to change yourself. You know? Because it's easy to change everything in the world, because you don't even have to change it, because it's changing faster than you can ever. It's changing faster than you could ever interfere with its. You can't interfere with its pace. You can't stop it from changing. You can't stop anything from changing. But on the other hand, you can't make yourself change. And that's the differentiation that needs to be made. Because, and it's not very hard to make it. It's not so difficult to make this differentiation. Because simply, you are always here. Sometimes when we think of self-knowledge and all of this, it becomes grandiose, as though there's a self other than me, the one who is always here. That's some idea where we have some, are working towards some sort of meditative experience to give me an experience of a self that's other than me. But self-knowledge is not about a self that's other than me. It's the recognition of the self that in fact I am, but have confused and mistaken to be one with my thoughts, one with my emotions, one with the body. There's no differentiation. That viviktarupa means that the chit, the conscious being that I am, needs to be differentiated. Not in terms of we've got the table on this side and the lamp on this side. See, the two are different. It's not like that. It's not that kind of differentiation. It's the recognition of, in my experience, like in this moment as your eyes are open and you have an experience of this room and the people who are in the room, the furniture, etc., there are two things happening. There's the perception of the room, and there's me, the conscious being, because of whom the perception is known. One is stable, one is changing. I have to use this viveka, this discrimination, to differentiate the changeless being that I am from the changing perceptions, changing emotions, you know, changing thoughts that are coming and going in my experience. And so sometimes contemplation is very useful for that, because we can slow down our experiences, because usually the mind's so caught up and so busy and so engaged in all of the things that are going on in the world, in my world, right? That I get totally kind of drowning in it. And so we have to slow down for a moment to recognize that in fact there is a lot going on. That's the nature of samsara, that's the nature of the world. There is a lot going on. But I am both immanent and transcendent. I am both totally pervasive to all that is going on and totally free of all that is going on at the same time. If that is the case, then this conscious being that I am is transcendent in the sense that it's not touched by anything that is going on. From my standpoint, from your standpoint, from your standpoint, from your standpoint, then what is it that makes, that limits consciousness to make me different from you, or to make me not the self of the entire creation? Because where are you going to bring in the boundaries? Where are you going to bring in the limitations to consciousness? You know, if you see in this room, for instance, if you see that my being, like the conscious being, is your conscious being, that there's only one conscious being here in this room, because everything else is objectifiable except for that consciousness. All the bodies are objectifiable, all the sense organs are objectifiable, all the thoughts are objectifiable, and all the emotions are objectifiable, even the ahankar, the I thought, I am, I am, I am, we're all saying I am, I am, I am, we're all objectify that thought. You don't walk around saying I all the time, it's just a thought. It's a thought that labels the conscious being, it's still a thought. Otherwise you would be I, and you're not. Not a necessary thought. Not a necessary thought. And so, if I am one in this room as a conscious being, then I am one, period. Where's the sticking point? So I'm one, period. And because I am one, period, then all of this, I am the consciousness which is the self of all of this. And so like the dream, like the imagination, this whole creation, the Shastra reveals, is something that comes from me, is sustained by me, and resolves into me. That's the achintya shakti. That's the limitless capacity, because I, the conscious being that I am, I have no hands and legs. I have no eyes from the standpoint of awareness. But this maya capacity is the achintya shakti, which is like, you can appreciate it, like your imagination. Like your imagination, how all capacity is manifest in that imagination. See that from a individual standpoint, from a subjective standpoint. You are the Ishwara. You are the Lord of the imagination, of your imagination, yourself. The conscious being from whom, so this is the relationship I want you to understand here. The conscious being from whom your imagination comes, right, has no hands and legs. The hands and legs belong to the imagination, to the beings in the imagination. You, the one from whom the imagination comes, has no eyes or ears. And yet, all eyes, all ears, all hands, all feet have come from you. Because of you, the sun, you know, holds its position. Because of you, the wind blows. Because of you, the grass grows. Right? Because the whole thing has come from you. And yet you are free of the whole thing. That's the Achintya Shakti. The whole universe is viewed like that. You as an individual, right? You as an individual, here we are, the individual. We are within the universe. This universe, this infinite universe, hasn't come from your subjective imagination as an individual within the universe. Just sit, like, imagine the meadow, and you have some characters in the meadow, and you're sitting in the meadow. You're in the meadow. You didn't imagine the meadow. That's not the level. Your being a person in the meadow, it's not that person in the meadow that imagined the meadow and put you in it. That's a different order of reality. The self, the truth of the self, which is the truth of the meadow, from that conscious being, the meadow imagination came. And you are that self. So you are the self of the meadow. It came from your being, but not from the individuals within the meadow. But all those individuals came from you. Right? So that's the Achintya Shakti in terms of this creation. We can understand it in reference to our personal imagination. Imagine now a character within the meadow. Say you're the character within the meadow, and you're looking around in the meadow, and you've got a guru, a teacher who comes to you, the character in the meadow, and says, "You know what? I should make it really more real than that." You, sitting in the meadow, you're saying, "Who am I?" You, the character in the meadow. "Who am I? What is the truth of me and this meadow?"
Uh-oh.
You know? Am I... Is this all there is? Is there something real, more real about me? Is there something that will outlast my death? You know? Is there a God? What is the reality of this creation? What is the truth of my being? And so you seek the teacher, you know, a wise person who seems to know. And now look at the job of that teacher. It's a big job, because that teacher has to make the student in the meadow recognize that he or she, the truth of the truth of you, is the conscious being from whom this whole meadow came, who is the very reality of the meadow, the very sut, the very being of the meadow, the consciousness which the meadow enjoys, the consciousness which every individual in the meadow enjoys, to the point where you have to be able to say, as the one who is seeking to know, you have to be able to say, I am both the meadow and I'm free of the meadow. I am the meadow, I am free of the meadow. That's what the dream character, I mean the meadow, one character in the meadow has to say. That's what you have to be able to say.
It's not enough just to say, oh, I'm pure consciousness, pure satchit, pure conscious, changes consciousness. No, that's not enough. You have to be able to say, I am the whole. And the whole includes this body, mind, sense organs. That's the whole vision of every Upanishad. That is the vision. Every Upanishad will give this vision in different ways, using what we call different prakriyas, different teaching methodologies, to make you see it in this way and in this way and this way, because it's not easy to see. Because for beginningless time, we'll look at the jiva, the individual, transmigrating individuals have been beginningless. How many lives have you had looking at reality from within the meadow? Everything, you know, everything that you think and feel and all of your networking, all of your connections, you know, are all from myself being an individual within the meadow. And yet the reality is that you're the self in whom the whole meadow exists. You're the self, in fact, in whom the whole universe exists. The being that you are, the being that I am, is the being that Ishwar, Ishwar means the Lord, is. Why do we even say the Lord? Why do we say it? Because this universe is a conscious being. That's why. The universe is a conscious being. That's why we say the Lord or Ishwara. When we say Lord or God, these words are loaded words because they're going to be only defined by the particular religion you were raised in. So you have to be careful. That's why, really, because if you say, I believe in God, you have to say, well, what God? What God do you believe in? Or say you say, you know, I'm an atheist. An atheist toward whom? You know? And so when we use a word like God or the Lord, it's better just to say Ishwara. You know, Ishwara, because that's a Sanskrit word for it, and then define what that means. If I say you are the Ishwara of your dream, or you are the Ishwara of your imagination, it means your being is the one from whom the entire imagination has come, by whom it is sustained, and in whom it is resolved. So Ishwara is the consciousness, the conscious being, which is you, in truth, you're the me that you are. God or Ishwara is the one from whom the whole time, space, manifest creation has come, is sustained and resolved into. So I am the whole. So I, in fact, am Ishwara. I am Ishwara. But not from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs. From the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, I am part of Ishwara. I am part of this creation. But from the standpoint of myself, of the conscious being, I am Ishwara. Just like in the meadow, you're a character in the meadow, that character should say, I am the one from whom this whole dream has come, and this body, mind, sense, organs is part of that dream. But in fact, I am the one from whom the whole dream has come. This is all me. It comes from me, it's sustained by me, and it resolves into me. The conscious being that I am, the very existence that the meadow enjoys, the consciousness the meadow enjoys, that is me. And so I'm the self of the meadow. But in reality, I'm the self also of this creation. There's not a difference there. So, okay, let's stop there. Just take a minute. Purnamada, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamadashate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vashishate, Om Shanti, 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Namaha.
Hare Om.
Sometimes I get a little confused in defining Ishvara when you think of these billions of galaxies with billions of stars, then you know, that kind of thought doesn't really help me too much, and it also is a little confusing.
It is.
Yeah.
But just think about, you know, like a cell on your little toe. What is it? How could it possibly conceive of you? You know, if you go into the, if you go from the standpoint of any limited part of infinity, you're going to get lost.
Yeah.
You know, if you go internally or externally.
Yeah.
But then, so that's not going to work, because
no.
You're doing it from the standpoint of an individual within a creation that is so vastly larger than yourself that you can't even imagine what that is. But one contemplation I like around that is that from the standpoint of yourself, consciousness, there's no big or small. It's not like consciousness is vast, vastly extending through space from its own standpoint. From the standpoint of consciousness, of just your being, there's no time or space. It's neither big nor small. It's not about dimension, because dimension belongs to duality. Like, for instance, if you imagine the meadow, the time and space exist within the meadow imagination. And meadow stands for any imagination. Or if you have a dream, the time, space, the dimension exists within the dream projection. Not consciousness. And yet, the dream, or the meadow, for instance, takes place in consciousness. Consciousness doesn't expand, but the space of the projection, you know, is pervasive to the projection, but the projection in its entirety, you know, exists in consciousness, which is neither big nor small. See what I mean? So that the dimension exists within duality, not within consciousness. But the dimension and the duality have for its being consciousness, which itself has no dimension. Why is that meaningful? Is that you don't need to become big or small in order to be present to whatever the duality is. From the standpoint of consciousness, it makes no difference. Like, I could ask you, instead of imagining a meadow, why don't you imagine the earth rotating around the sun? That's a bigger imagination. It takes more space within the imagination than just a little tiny meadow. But if I ask you to imagine this room, shut your eyes and imagine the room, that's a little imagination. Whatever the imagination is, though, your being is what, you know, fills it. So there is no distance between you and whatever it is. So size is very, very relative. So the cell to your body is inconceivable. Who you are is inconceivable to your little cell.
Yeah, I see that. What about the idea of thinking that If I were just more perceptive, or if I were more intelligent, then I would understand consciousness?
Well, consciousness...
Or...
You can say that within Maya, or if I had a better memory, or if I was just a little sharper, maybe I would... You know, I like the memory one myself.
Yeah. Sounds like a super ego.
But, you know, it's all relative, and there's probably an infinite higher intelligence from you and infinite lower, if you want to put it on a scale.
Yeah.
And so, but consciousness doesn't have to do with duality. You know? Consciousness is one without a second.
and it's you.
Right.
And it's also totally present as the very truth of your mind, kind of like how the clay is present to the pot. If you have a clay pot, you know, how present is the clay to the pot? You know, what is it going to take for the pot to recognize the clay? It will take viveka. It takes viveka. Viveka means discrimination. So you do need that type of intelligence, the ability to discriminate, or that capacity.
Mm. So, I think I've asked this question before, but in terms of the jiva's relationship to Ishvara.
The what? Jiva's relationship?
Jiva's, if you, you know, Ishvara being manifest intelligence, or a conscious universe, right? Manifest knowledge.
Mm.
And that manifest knowledge is, you know, if you think of human emotions, is can be good or evil, or it can be indifferent if you just think of the intelligence that's created the universe and all the worlds. But then when I say as a jiva that I want to have a relationship with that manifest knowledge that can be good, evil, or indifferent,
mm-hmm.
then I am free to say I want to have a relationship with the aspect that is good, with the aspect that is...
Well, I think we're, you know, maybe a little differently with it from that. Whereas, first of all, in kind of Upanishads, we don't accept evil as though evil has a kind of a separate being, like God and the devil, for instance. You know, where mm-hmm. evil has its own kind of a force, like there's an evil force.
Yeah. I was thinking more in terms of just human emotion. You know,
okay, but human emotion then, the human emotions and reactions and all of that are generated by our relationship to the world. So in the end, the human emotions are generated by self-ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because mm-hmm. just that you have a gamut of emotions from, you know, love and compassion and, you know, saintliness, all of the kind of feelings that we actually value to be a good person, a loving person, a person who cares about others. And then we have these other emotions where, oh my God, you know, of hatred, of anger, of jealousy, of bitterness. So there's a polar opposites, you know, there's a whole range of emotions. Now, what generates those emotions? And we say, what generates the emotion is my relationship to the object. And it's basically, if I believe that I need this object, this person, this situation in order to be happy, then all of the people and situations that help me to satisfy that, to fulfill that desire, are my friends, and I have benign emotions toward them. All of the people that thwart the fulfillment of that desire in whatever variety of ways will generate the negative emotions like hatred and jealousy and agitation and frustration and rage and bitterness, and they're all of these emotions are generated by my relationship to my attachment to the object in terms of its ability to make me happy. Now, all of that takes place because I superimpose the very source, the self, which is the very source of ananda, onto the object. And so that's what's generating the emotions, my reactions, my acting out, all of that.
But that's not part of Ishvara, right?
It's everything, but that's the order, because Ishvara is infinite order.
Right.
But that infinite order that produces this whole range of emotion is brought about by self-ignorance. That's why there's such a thing as liberation, because if I were intrinsically, by my nature, my very nature, full and complete and whole, what can I do? You just have to say, all right, by my nature, I'm incomplete, subject to birth and death, and I have to go on struggling for my fullness.
You know, there's no, that is bondage. But it's not that you're right that order is there,
mm-hmm.
Ishwar's order.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, that's why we do meditations on that sometimes, like say, like this. I might be jumping too far for some of you, but I'll just, you know, I still have to do it. One meditation is, say, I have a in relationship with someone who is causing me a great deal of pain. Just the samsara, and we all have these situations where there's a relationship with someone who's causing a great deal of pain. You can actually objectify that relationship, so now there's you and the other person, and there's the situation that has just happened that has caused a great deal of hurt, so that's generating a hurtful emotion. And so now what you can see is, here's me on this side, and here's this person on this side. This is what has been going on with them. This is their past. This is the sequence of events that have led up to them responding in this way. This is the sequence of events in their past that has led to, for me responding in this way. And then what you see is that the emotions, the laws, or the situation that has produced this emotion, and that is Ishwara.
Mm.
This is it's a complex situation. It's not just, you know, all of a sudden this person did this and this person did that, and then there's this volcano that has erupted.
So when there's anger there, it really fits in with the pattern, with the order, the pattern.
Yeah.
It's legitimate. I mean,
Well, it's legitimate in the sense that this order and this sequence of events produces this. It's kind of like a chemistry project.
Oh, it has to, you know? Yeah.
This type of sequence of events produces this emotion. That's the karmapala. To all of these things, you know, to all of these things that involve. And so, but what's so useful about seeing that is you become, gain a distance from it.
Mm.
It becomes objectified, and you can also kind of change the mix a little bit, because you can see all of the things that went into producing this effect, which is in the form of whatever happens to be acted out at the time, you know. And then you can give that all, recognize it all as Ishwara also, which I think is helpful. You recognize the whole thing as Ishwara and you give it to Ishwara. And
should that be my relationship with that order, with manifesting knowledge, is to see it in that way and to recognize it, which is...
Because when you're doing that, then you're left as the Atma, and you see the whole complexity, including the emotions that have been generated as Ishwara. Yeah.
And can you do that not only with negative response, but also with positive?
It's beautiful to do with positive responses also, but, you know, positive responses, we're all kind of... we're all like great jnanis, mahatmas, you know? And then when everything's just fine, then I'm happy. But that isn't even true, you know, when everything's fine... There's worry underneath. Something can happen to take this away. Because we're smart, we know. It's true. If to whatever degree you require the world to be in a particular way, then you know you're basically screwed. because the world doesn't stop moving. People don't stop changing. It's so wretched in a way, because you can so much want someone or something, you know? And then it's not just they who will change. You can change.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want them anymore. You wanted them so badly, you wanted that situation so badly, and you were so enamored, so in love, or whatever it is. And then all of a sudden that goes away. Or it goes away in the other person. But it's not just the other person. It can go away in you too, and then you're left with a situation which now you don't want. This is all projection. It's all projection. you know. So and there's karma involved too. That's why you can have very long term relationships. That's a whole different issue.
So that's why it's kind of a nice analogy with like chemistry project, you know, because you can literally change one ingredient and you don't have the explosion
everything.
Anymore.
That's right. We even teach that, you know, in psychology and systems theory if you're doing family counseling. You know, just change one thing in the mix. The whole thing has to change. Yeah.
It just needs to have enough impact.
Yeah, but so you change one thing and then the other person has to respond to it. You know,
right.
It's just...
Yeah. Can it be just a little thing or does it have to be something?
Yeah, no little thing.
You know, I got a question too, if I may ask you. There's a, I had this talk with somebody and they said, well, you know, if the incentive is to be free from attachment because you know that attachment causes a certain amount of dukkha, right? Then, or suffering, then if now the incentive is to free oneself from the attachment, that's really meant more in terms of having an awareness of where your attachment goes, right? Because you're never free of attachment. I mean, you're always like, you have an attachment to having a roof even, or I mean, it becomes subtler and subtler, even if you decide to live in the forest, you have an attachment to, you know, the sun shining on your tent or something because you want to be warm, or you know what I mean? It's just like subtler
and
subtler.
Yeah, you have to say, what happens is, say if I use the desire template, where you, everyone says, you know, I want this in order to be happy. I want this, like I want a roof over my head in order to be happy. What happens for a jnani is you just say, I want the roof. Your happiness isn't dependent on it.
Right.
That's the freedom. Mm-hmm. If I don't have the roof, then I'll take some actions to do whatever I need to do to shelter myself. It's not that I've lost my fullness or my wholeness, but on a practical level, I need the roof. And so this idea of thinking it's a practice, it's not a practice to give up your attachment. It's knowledge. In other words, when you recognize the source of the ananda that you're seeking, it's no longer, I want this to be happy. It goes like this. I want this to be happy. And then I want this to be happy. I want this to be happy. No, actually, I just want to be happy. Right? I want to be happy. This, I realize the illusion of this. I want this to be happy. Sometimes I want this. Sometimes I don't want this. Sometimes, you know, I don't, this is neutral to me. Actually, this has nothing to do with it. But the fact is, I always do want to be happy. And so where is the locus of the happiness or the wholeness or the fullness that I seek?
Mm-hmm.
When I discover, not intellectually, I have to understand intellectually, but when I discover the reality that the source of the wholeness or the ananda, the fullness that I seek, is the self.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It is the self. And the great trick is that whenever you fulfill a desire, the mind becomes desireless for that moment. That's the whole trick. You fulfill a desire, you have a few seconds there of desirelessness. And in that moment, that's like a samadhi for the mind. And the self reflects in that mind in a way that that gives the mind the feeling of happiness. But actually the wholeness of the self, that's why it's good to just, when you know that in meditation when I was asking you, what are you like? What is this being, the conscious being? What are you like? Is it whole? Is it limited? Is it something that you want to change in any way? And the answer is invariably no. In fact, it's the one thing you can't even conceive of changing, because then you wouldn't be there.
And can't so hold on to it either. I mean,
you don't need to hold on to it because you can't get rid of it. You just have to recognize it. And then the mind, what happens is the mind, instead of going out trying to hang on to this and hang on to this and hang on to this so I can be happy, rests at home, and from that position experiences the world of good and bad. It's not like you gain self-knowledge and the world, you know, shapes up.
So
it doesn't shape up.
So
it's plenty difficult.
So the desire for the house or the home is still there, but there's just not the projection that that will bring you happiness.
Yeah, you have the desire without the inability to be without that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot different, because your karma, the very karmas that took you, brought you into this birth, will manifest in terms of desires. I want this, and I want to do this job, I want to get this education, you know, I want to have children, whatever it is. All of these things. But the difference is that I can have these things, and when they go, I can let them go also. Swamiji always uses this helium balloon example.
Mm-hmm.
That for a baby, a child, you know, that helium balloon is, there's a big attachment to it. It's a really great toy. It's a really great thing to have. And when it invariably, you know, flies up into the sky, that can be a big hurt for the child, but it's not going to be for an adult. And you like it, you have fun with it, you know, your kids have a helium balloon and you have one and it's fun. But when it goes, that's fun too, it's fine, whatever, you know, it doesn't matter. It's not that I'm not engaged with it or having fun or liking it, you know, I can be totally involved in it, but it's all right if it goes. That's what we mean by vairagya. That's the dispassion. It's all. It's fine that it's here, and it's fine that it goes. And I recently talked with my teacher, with Swamiji, about this in terms of negative things, because when negative things come into your space, that's not necessarily fine. I'd much rather they go. He doesn't view it that way at all, you know. He just deals with whatever comes into the space, he's there, present to it. And when it goes, it goes. You know, it's, we usually only look at that type of vairagya in terms of the positive, something that you really want comes in, you have it, and then it goes, and you have to be free to let it go. But you also have to be free to let the negative come in and deal with it and let it go. That's a beautiful thing to be able to, because otherwise, you know, there's negative anticipatory anxiety, you know, like this problem is going to come, I'm going to have to deal with it, or if there's somebody, you know, you have to deal with, they're just lurking there on the sidelines, and you're putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, and that's kind of like this type of thing. Instead of just letting that rather unpleasant or hurtful or difficult situation, it's there, it needs to be dealt with, deal with it and let it go.
It seems to me the whole time it's just like a definition of where is your well-being? I mean,
that's right, but that's the vairagya.
Yeah.
Is to deal with what is there to be dealt with and be engaged with it while it's there, and let it go when it goes.
Isn't there a sense in which, though, before you, when you're in a state in which you know you want to search for self-knowledge, that having and entertaining negative things and being attached to them is one of the means by which you are pointed towards that.
Putting the pain that your situation has caused you.
And you need to pay attention to that in order to have the stimulus to search for liberation.
Well, you know, that's interesting. That's actually what we call that is jihasa vairagya, as opposed to jignasa vairagya. Jihasa vairagya means there's difficult things happening, right? And so, you know, I don't want that. I don't even, if this is the way life's going to be, you know, if this is the way life's going to be, with so many difficulties, so many problems, I just don't want anything to do with it. I might as well shoot myself or go to the, you know, go to the forest and go get a teacher and do something else, because it just is, you know, too hard. But then, if that's the only amount of vivekha, discrimination that has taken place, then what happens is
there's a turn of events, and now everything's going really well. All those bad things went away, and now life is going really wonderfully and smoothly. And you say, oh no, that everything's fine now. And you're right back in the same samsara. So difficult events, hard situations can make you analyze your situation in a way that is universal, you know, rather than specific. So that if it's specific, then these things are so difficult, I don't want anything to do with it. I think I just want to gain liberation. But if it's only specific, then what happens? The situation changes. No, I don't need liberation right now. Let me forget it. Everything's fine. Like that. But if the difficult situation leads to the recognition of the universal truth, you know, then it's helpful. It's very helpful. Right? It's because that's true what you're saying. Well, what if this is what we say, Swargaloka, like a heaven world? Everything's fine all the time. You want something? There it is. You don't want something? It's gone. You don't have to worry. Your life is just as you would always like it to be, so you don't need any liberation or anything. Even though that's relative and it comes to an end still. But we don't have to worry about that here. This world is not Swargaloka. You know, this world, by its very nature, throws all kinds of opportunities for pain, all kinds of them. Because they even say that to take a birth here is a tremendous blessing, because you're available, you actually gain karma, you have doership, you know, you have the capacity for doership. But that the karmas that brought you here are 50-50 punya and papa. That means that the manifestation of this life will have 50% situations that are difficult in one way or another, and 50% that are meant to be pleasurable in one way or another for you, you know? And so that's why, you know, the samsara is kind of like this, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. Everything's going fine, and then this hard thing happens, and then things are going fine again, and then this hard thing happens. And sometimes things are hard for a long time, basically hard for a long time with little moments of sukha, pleasure. And then there'll be other periods when everything's just going so well for a good period of time, with a little bits of dukkha here and there, sorrow here and there. And other times it's, but, you know. But it all works out to about 50-50. That's what they say.
That's part of the order.
You know, sometimes I tell students, it's kind of an interesting exercise to write your biography, write, you know, two versions. It's like taking a piece of paper and putting a line down the middle. And on the one side, you can write this, it's just this wonderful, beautiful, yeah, this beautiful life that you've had. Okay, all of these opportunities, all of the wonderful things, and that will make its own storyline. And on the other side,
it's
hell. It's a very, very tough. And then so you have to, then you hold both of them. Here's the heaven and here's the hell, and then you bring them together. You know? But it's useful to do, because everybody has two storylines. One that's very difficult, one that's very beautiful.
So if you add that up, it's just...
Well, one thing is just to see, it'll help you objectify your life and kind of see
see it
a little differently, see it in a more complete way. And also it's helpful when you're on the negative side to remember the positive.
Yeah.
You know, because both are there. Both are there. It's very interesting.
Yeah. You know? I never thought of that.
Yeah. And the beautiful life is really... really beautiful. You know, there's so many wonderful things that have happened, so many opportunities. And it's like a little love story. And then the other side, there's tremendous hardship also.
for everybody. Everybody has their own cross of things that have been very, very difficult in their life. It's how it is.
Well, no one gets out then, huh?
Nobody's spared. But there is, and that's why eventually you seek liberation.
Yeah.
At some point you say, you know what? This doesn't work. There is no way to get off the train here in terms of trying to gain a stable, lasting, all is well with me state.
Mm-hmm.
To the degree, if you're dependent on anything within duality, any type of stable, all is well with me, is absolutely impossible. If you're dependent on what is by nature subject to birth and death to change, it's not possible to do that. It's totally different. If you're not dependent on it, then it can go its own way and do what it does, and you're fine. But you can't be dependent on it. And the only thing that is free from change and whole and complete is the self. That's why, in the end, that's where the resolution has to be. You know, other different spiritual disciplines will deal with this in different ways, but in the end, you have to know yourself. You know, because otherwise, you're just trying to manage the universe, have attitudes. You still take yourself to be a limited, changing being, but you try to practice attitudes, you know, to keep it at bay. But at some point, you need to be able to get off the train where you can just say, oh, okay, I don't have to work at this anymore. But the only way that you don't have to work at it is if the self that you are is free of time. Is free of time and change. And that is you. Then there's nothing you can do about it. You can't do anything about it. So you don't have to make it better or worry about making it worse. You're free. That's the end of it. There's nothing to do. Then you can relax. Other than that, to whatever degree you're caught up within the duality, you have to work at it. It's just how it is. Okay, we better stop.